Welcome to Senate Finance. It's Thursday, April 14th. This morning, we have Co-Chair Kelly present.
Hello.
Senator Hoffman.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
This morning, we're going to be taking public testimony from 8 to 9 on SB 130, tax credits, interest, refunds, oil, and gas. We have some folks online. Anything else members need to communicate before we get started with public testimony?
Mr. Chairman, I have a bill up in House Finance. I don't know when that's going to be, but I assume it's going to be between 8:30 and 9 o'clock.
Okay. The other member, or the other items on today's agenda, HB 77, disability, ID license and training requirements, HCR 4, U.S. Counterman Convention delegates, HB 314, Alaska Regulatory Economic Assistance, I think. It's abbreviated SB 206, reinsurance program, and SB 55, optometry and optometrists. We will begin public testimony on SB 130. First up, we have Mr. Brad Faulkner from Homer. Mr. Faulkner, you have 2 minutes. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony. Mr. Faulkner? Okay. We, whenever Homer gets connected, please indicate that. So we'll go to Dave Hansen at the Anchorage LAO. Mr. Hansen. Mr. Hansen, can you hear us? Brief at ease.
Later.
Okay, we're back here in Juneau to testify on SB 130. Sorry if I don't get the first name correctly, but Marlianna Hall. Good morning, Ms. Hall. If you can identify yourself for a record, the record and any affiliation, you have 2 minutes.
Good morning. My name is Marlianna Hall. I am the Executive Director for the Resource Development Council for Alaska. My members are the lifeblood of Alaska's economy. We believe the best approach to expand the economy and generate new revenues for the state is to produce more oil, attract more tourists, harvest more fish, and mine more minerals. With regard to committee substitute SB 130, raising taxes on companies that are reporting record losses and are in negative cash flow is not sound fiscal policy. Increasing taxes on our natural resource industries will not increase production for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. It will not encourage the development of new mines in Alaska, and it will not attract more tourists. It will also not boost investment in the fishing industry. Higher taxes in this low commodity price environment will likely deter investment and lead to lower state revenues and a weaker private sector over the long run. Changing the oil tax regime now will only make a bad situation worse. But some good news. Several news outlets recently announced an increase of year-over-year oil production during the past 12 months. This is the first increase in throughput since 2002. More proof the current tax regime is working. When you incentivize something, you get more of it. We need to incentivize the industry to drill more, to create more wealth, create more activity, and aim for next year's production to be even higher than this year's. The oil industry is truly the foundation of Alaska's economy, and keeping it strong is the key to sustaining the private sector, Alaskan jobs, state government, and the overall economy. Conversely, SB 130 moves us in the wrong direction. It represents the sixth major tax change in Alaska in the last 11 years. My members are not asking for a tax decrease during this low commodity price time like other states and countries are considering, but instead, as you consider changing the tax policy, it asks that we do no harm to the state's largest industry. Co-chairs and members of the Senate Finance Committee, I thank you for the opportunity to provide RDC's perspective on this bill and encourage you to reject this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Hall.
Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Hall for finance members? Seeing none, thank you very much. And I should welcome this morning Senator Dunleavy. Next online, we have Brad Faulkner from Homer. Let's try that again. Mr. Faulkner, can you hear me?
Yeah, my name is Brad Faulkner. I'm a lifelong resident of Alaska. I started working on the pipeline when I was 18. I worked my way through Harvard University, getting a degree in economics. I've worked in the oil industry off and on most of my life. I spent more time fishing than anything. I'm in favor of the governor's bill, and I'm in favor of getting rid of oil tax credits. Oil tax credits are supposed to be an investment by the state. As an investment, they've been a lousy investment. The oil tax credits in the inlet will never pay themselves off if you apply interest to it. The oil tax credits on the North Slope, where you're taxing on the net and then rebating taxes on the gross, are set up to essentially pump the last 3.5 billion barrels of easy lift oil that we have up there for nothing, for free. The last time I went up there, I towed the Kulik up on the Ivet. If the state had the same kind of tax credits in the Chukchi that we have in the inlet, we would have dumped about $4 billion down a dry hole along with Shell. So when I look at Juneau and the Senate in particular right now, it's controlled by the oil industry. So the oil industry writes the tax legislation. You guys go down there and pass it. And the state of Alaska and the citizens of Alaska are going to have to reach into our pockets and pay them. It's long since time to get rid of it. Under the ELF, we had 80% of the oil leaving the slope from the two largest oil fields in America with zero production tax. Under this tax scenario, with all income streams from oil, we still have several hundred million dollars being paid out by the general fund to the oil industry every year. Anyway, I'm a long time Alaskan. I understand the numbers, and you guys need to do something about the oil taxes. There's going to be a lot of pain in this state, and they need to share the pain along with the citizens.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Faulkner. Any questions for Mr. Faulkner? Seeing none, thank you. Now off to the Anchorage LIO, Mr. David Hansen. Mr. Hansen, you have 2 minutes.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Finance Committee Chairman and members. My name is Dave Hansen. I am a fiscal conservative 40-year Alaskan resident. I'm in favor of SB 130 because we cannot afford the oil production tax credit program. We cannot afford any $500 million to $1 billion tax credit program, no matter who it's on. Recent discussion of the oil production tax credit program has been dominated by hours of oil industry testimony. However, this input does not necessarily reflect the broader interests of the people of Alaska, and some input is misleading. For example, the oil industry no longer pays for 90% of the state budget. Oil revenue now provides about 26% of the budget. The state is primarily dependent on state savings accounts and investment earnings to pay for the budget. Another example, low oil prices, not the oil production tax structure, are why the industry is having financial challenges. The industry's problem is that development projects are no longer economical at low oil prices. But that does not justify the tax credit subsidies that we cannot afford. I say this even though we all respect and are very much in favor of the oil industry. The industry highlights the importance of oil industry jobs, but we need to remind ourselves that oil industry jobs, though important, we've also cut other jobs that are important, such as $400 million of capital project jobs eliminated from last year's budget, or laid off state troopers, teachers, university employees, and others. Oil industry jobs do not justify keeping the tax credit subsidies. Please, in conclusion, please consider the following questions. Is it the state of Alaska's obligation to carry the oil industry at a great loss when oil prices are low? Is it the legislature's intent that the oil industry gets a budget pass while the rest of the state pays for it? Do the people of Alaska want to give up $1,000 of their PFDs to pay for oil tax credits? How will we pay for the credits? Please represent the interests of all Alaskans and not just the oil companies as you're considering this. I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Questions for Mr. Hansen? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Here in the room, we have Barbara Huff-Tuckness. Barbara, if you can please state your name and affiliation for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. I'm Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959. We represent approximately 7,000 members, many of which do work on the North Slope. We're here to talk with you about Senate Bill 130. While we recognize the situation financially that the governor as well as the legislators here are facing with respect to our financial issues, I'm not here today to talk about, I guess, any specific proposed changes to the bill. I think the CS is much better than the original bill that was introduced. But to bring in perspective from, I guess, the impact that we see it, which is jobs. We have several hundred members that actually work on the slope. We have several contracts, Doyen, Nanook. We also have work with Alyeska Pipeline, the Valdez area, as well as K&L Distributors, Usabelli Mine. So we also get a perspective on some of the other legislation that's moving around in our state right now. And we just like to go on record saying we do believe that Senate Bill 21 is working. We believe that the impact out there with respect to jobs, with respect to production going into the pipeline has definitely been working. We believe that the state of Alaska, the people in Alaska are actually better off as a result of the passage, the passage of that bill, and encourage you, whatever decision you end up ultimately making with the bill, that you do keep in mind the impact on jobs out there. And the least amount of jobs that get cut, definitely the better.
Thank you, Barbara. Any questions for Ms. Huff-Tuckness? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Moving back up to the Anchorage LIO, we have Renee Reeve. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Renee Limoges Reeve, and I'm calling in on behalf of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. I believe that you all know our position on the bill, and for that reason, I'm going to take my 2 minutes to allow the members of the Alliance who are here in the room with us to identify themselves and their affiliation.
Ben Schaffman, Akita Asset Management.
Reed Christensen, Dallenbach Corporation.
Terry Smith, Unified Operations.
Chantal Walsh, CIA.
Mike Herring with Hugo Hogan Oilfield.
Kathy Duxbury with Hugo Hogan Oilfield.
Scott Vieira from North Star Terminal in Stevedore.
Pete Stokes with PRA.
Intercap with Hawk Consultants.
Patrick Welsh with Pete Goldfield Service Company.
Jeff Bence from North Star Terminal in Stevedore.
Dale Cassini with Conan Construction.
Maria Talis, Stantec Consulting.
Adam Crum, Northern Industrial Training.
Rita Fitzhugh with Hawk Consulting.
Carrie Ann Cardi with the Alaska Process Industry Careers Consortium.
Joseph Colonel, Colonel Associates.
Steve Post from North Star Equipment Services.
Martha Peck, Alaska Process Industry Careers Consortium.
Nick Pepperworth of Eagle Hoven Oilfield.
Dennis Hebner, Superior Machine and Welding.
Brian Benson, Air Liquide.
Joey Crum, Northern Industrial Train.
So in conclusion, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, everyone that you just heard from is opposed to SB 130 and any tax changes that further impact the industry at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Renee. Members, any questions for Renee or any of the, I believe, 18 members that just testified? It may have been fun to be able to have a video of how that all worked just then.
There were a couple hiccups, but we think we did okay.
We heard some whispering. Okay, thank you. Thanks to all of you for testifying this morning. Next, we have Michael Jesperson, Anchorage, OffNet, I'm sorry, from Anchorage. Mr. Jesperson, you have 2 minutes.
Hi, this is Michael Jesperson. I'm in Anchorage, testifying on my own behalf. For the record, neither I nor anyone in my family does or ever has worked for an oil services company or oil company. And speaking for my wife and my 20-year-old son, who is a UAA student, we oppose raising taxes. The industry is on the ropes right now anyway, and they're going to have to cut investing if you guys keep messing with the oil taxes. 6 times in 11 years to mess with the taxes, nobody is going to invest in that. It's crazy to keep changing the rules and expect people to invest money. The best way to help the state of Alaska through a financial crisis is to get people jobs. The largest employer is the oil and gas industry, so it makes sense not to kill the golden goose. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jesperson. Questions from committee members? Seeing none. Thank you for your testimony. That's all we have online so far this morning. We have 30 minutes left. I'm going to take a brief at ease because we need another member for a quorum, and we could move along on a couple bills that we have before us. So we're going to take an at ease for just a moment. We are going to move around on our agenda a little bit, waiting for another member. Folks are busy this morning, and the bill we are going to bring up is HB 314. Here with us this morning, we have extending the Alaska Regional Economic Assistance Program, the ARTER bill. We have Representative Shelley Hughes and staff here to present the bill. If you want to join us, identify yourself for the record, and you can certainly begin presenting your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm Shelley Hughes, District 11, Palmer. First, I want to thank you all for the extra hard work and long hours you're putting in here at the end of the session. And the ARTER bill, HB 314, will reauthorize the ARTERs. I believe you're all familiar with the program. They're economic development organizations throughout the state. And in this time of fiscal challenge, it's very important that this work continue because this means economic growth and jobs. And so originally the bill extended, instead of the typical 3-year, 5 years, and removed the reporting requirements, or and that didn't remove them, but made them subject to state funding. And because this program is not being funded by the state this year, it seemed onerous for all the reporting to continue, because we had beefed that up last time to increase accountability for state dollars used. So it relieved them of that. But in Senate Labor and Commerce, a very good point was made that if we don't have some sense of what's going on, we'll lose track of important information about the economic activity across the state. So it was changed to allow some reporting, and in exchange for that, the sunset date was removed. So I believe the ARTERs are pretty happy with that, because they won't have to come back here in 3 years or 5 years and request reauthorization. I just want to point out, if there's concern about them not being getting state funding, it came out to about $70,000. An ARTER, and for the smaller ones, that is a nice chunk of change to get work done, but it is an amount that's not insurmountable. And so we believe, basically, because 89% of their funding in a year typically is not state funding, it's coming from other sources, that they'll be able to continue their work. And they are really great organizations doing good things throughout the state. Copper Valley has assisted 7 startups in the last year. Swampsea has a great focus on manufacturing, and I think that might turn out to be manufacturing related to seafood, and I'm very excited what that might mean for us here in Alaska. The YK area is manufacturing roof trusses for cold climate housing. So there's just a myriad of good things happening around the state, and they need the designation in order to be recognized as far as seeking other funding. Occasionally, for instance, in Anchorage, they work with foreign entities, and that official state recognition is important. The state official designation is important, too, as they seek to work with the federal government, which they do on occasion as well.
Thank you, Representative Hughes. Questions for the representative before we go on to a sectional? Seeing no questions, thank you. If you can have your staff identify himself for the record and provide a brief sectional, that would be helpful. We plan to hear and hold this bill today. So please proceed.
Sure. My name is Stuart Kruger. I'm staff representative Shelley Hughes. So I will go through a summary of changes between the original bill version N to the Senate Labor and Commerce version P. There were some substantive changes. Page 3, lines 6 through 11, the CS for Senate Labor and Commerce reinstated the reporting requirement that the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development compile and deliver a report to the Senate Secretary and Chief Clerk on regional development organization activities. It does so by removing the language from the original bill, starting on page 3, line 9, stating that in the preceding fiscal year received assistance under A of this 10 section or a grant under B of this section. So those reporting requirements for both the department and the auditors were previously subject to whether or not they got any assistance or funding in the preceding fiscal year. That section has been removed, and it's back to the original language that's in statute currently. And then on page 4, line 9, it repeals the sunset clause altogether. So section 1 of the CS goes, it lists the duties of the department in assisting the formation of auditors. Section 2, it lists that, or it gives the department the ability to give grants to auditors. Section 3 is the reporting requirements for the auditors to compile an annual report and the information that they'll seek from the auditors themselves. And Section 4, which was repealed, was that sunset clause. So now the auditors will be able to operate without the bill coming before the legislature every 3 to 5 years. And Section 5 was just a retroactivity clause. And that is a brief run-through of the sectional.
Thank you, Mr. Krueger. Questions for Mr. Krueger or Representative Hughes? I just have one question for you. The fiscal note still has a $774,100 grant, which has been removed in the subcommittee budgets. I assume as the budgets close out, we'll get a new zero fiscal note for this bill.
Actually, Mr. Chair, we worked with the department, and that is provided. That second column is information only. It was in the governor's original budget request that he put forward in December, but the department worked with us and before the subcommittee process agreed to go to zero, and we worked with the chairs of those of the associated subcommittees, and they did zero it out at that point. So it is now zero in the budget, and technically legislative finance says this is really a zero fiscal note, that because that column is informational only, so it's maybe somewhat of an odd duck, but it is already been zeroed out, Mr. Chair.
That's perfect. Thank you, Representative Hughes. Good morning, Senator Olson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
If there are no other questions on HB 314, please, we're going to hold this bill if you can set it aside. Thank you, Representative.
214.
I have a new person to testify on Senate Bill 130. And then if you can please find HB 77 in your stack of bills here, members, we'll move to that unless we have new folks that want to testify. Mr. Cook, you have 2 minutes if you can please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on SB 130. SB 130, I came here to testify to something else. I mean, it's the same as 247 on the other side. It has fairly significant negative impacts to South Central and actually the entire rail belt of Alaska by at least a component of it that deals with Cook Inlet. There's a difference in who the consumers are in Cook Inlet than North Slope production. And now those of us that are the consumers of energy, be it through electricity, natural gas, gasoline in South Central and the Rail Belt, utilize Cook Inlet resources. The imposition of additional tax or the elimination of production tax credits and other incentives for Cook Inlet end up in the pocketbook of Alaskans, not consumers in the lower 48 or other places in the world as it relates to North Slope production. So I would encourage the Senate Finance Committee, please look at
the ultimate consumer of the resource and who would bear the burden of the change in the tax and credit structure. You know, there are certainly some positive changes that could be made, but the sweeping proposed changes in this legislation, I think, would be damaging to the pocketbooks of Alaskans. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate all of your hard work in the closing days of the session.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Questions for Mr. Cook? Seeing none, I see no one else online to testify on HB. Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, I do have someone. Mr. Don Lachak from Anchorage.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your time. Again, I'm a resident of Anchorage for over 30 years, and I have worked for several different oil companies, the big and the small. I see a growing part of Alaska oil productions with the non-major oil companies seeking these smaller fields, because I believe that the smaller fields are the true future of Alaska. The smaller companies always seem to be more nimble to keep the cost down. They risk more of their company to succeed, and if it's going to be more difficult to raise the capital to explore, and then as profits are decreasing, it gets very difficult. You know, with all the processing costs of production, the lift costs, processing fees, pipeline fees, royalty fees, taxes, you know, you ask yourself, at least I ask myself, what is going to be left? And now that the rules are changing, it becomes even more difficult. So putting, of course, more money into the ground than you take out is going to be a big economic disaster. But we need to pursue the smaller oil fields. That's what's going to keep, I believe, Alaska moving forward. We need to keep Alaska investments out of the red, and we need to keep the Alaska workers producing more oil, and to keep Alaska really truly open for business. So increasing taxes, especially on the small oil companies, that to me only is going to shrink the investments and limit the productions. So I appreciate your time, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lachak. Can you pronounce your name again for the record?
Yes, my name is Don Lachak.
Okay, thank you for that. Thanks for your testimony. I have no one else online for Senate Bill 130. And committee members, I hate to jump around here, but we have Representative Hughes. Why don't we pick up HCR 4, the U.S. Counterman Convention delegates. And we plan to move this bill this morning. We took public testimony on 4, 5 of 16 for the same bill as SCR 4. So, Representative Mr. Krueger, if you can please cover your bill here and any differences we might have, but begin by identifying yourself for the record.
Good morning. Good to be back again so soon. Shelley Hughes, District 11, Palmer. HCR 4 is the resolution that works in tandem with another one that is now in Senate rules, and it's an effort to call for a countermand single issue amendment convention. The word countermand, as a reminder, just simply means veto. And I know that you did hear the companion to this, I believe about 2 weeks ago with my staff, Stuart Krueger. But just as a quick a reminder, what it is it would give, it's an attempt to restore the balance between the state and federal governments. And I do want to point out that it is not that the federal government is the enemy. It is not that the, I think I've said, it's not the hairy monster. Sometimes we get very frustrated with the federal government. And usually it's two reasons, because they overstep, they're doing things that should the state should be doing, and sometimes the folks in Washington, D.C. just do not know what is best for a state. And so this amendment, a call for the convention, would allow states, if something were so egregious that 30 states agreed in a very short time frame, which is an 18-month time frame, which would be quite a miracle for 30 states to do that, so I believe it would be used sparingly, could, if they agreed that a particular federal decision, whether that is something passed by Congress, a federal regulation, a judicial decision, or an executive order, if it were not in the best interest of the state, that it would become null and void. So this resolution before you lays out the instructions for the delegates, and it's very important for the public record for this to go through with the call for the convention, because we all, I believe we all hold very dearly the U.S. Constitution. I know I do, and I don't want it dismantled. And so by laying out the instructions, it's very clear that the delegates could not begin to address other parts of the Constitution and make other changes. They would have to stick to this one mechanism that is the attempt to restore the balance between the state and the federal governments. And that is just a quick overview, Mr. Chair, and my staffer is happy to go through any of the particulars as far as those instructions and how that process with the delegates would work.
Thank you, Representative Hughes. As I said, we did hear the bill. It's identical to the bill we heard at SCR 4, and we did take public testimony on 4 or 5 of 16. Any questions from committee members? I do have an individual online that would like to testify, and he's been online for a little while. I think we'll go ahead and take this individual, Mr. Mike Coons. If you can please identify yourself for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Yes, I'm from Michigan. This is Mike Coons, National Legislative Director for Citizen Initiatives. Just wanted to thank the committee for hearing this bill, getting this up and running so we can get it passed out, and I look forward to a full vote of yes and getting this passed and Alaska leading the way to the other states. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. Thanks for calling me. With that, the only fiscal note we have is fiscal note number 2, which is indeterminate. The reason for that is it's a zero fiscal note unless, well, I'll read from the back page here. Because there are so many variables in this resolution and because the timeline is unknown, the fiscal note is indeterminate. Should this legislation pass and a counterman amendment convention be scheduled, an updated fiscal note will be required. So we just lost our quorum for moving the bill. Brief at ease. Senator Dunleavy, did you have a question or comment? No? Okay. Well, we have a quorum. Do we have a motion, Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS Proust Bill 77 Finance /P to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you, Senator. But if you can please restate your motion with HCR 4.
Okay. I got the wrong folder. I was trying to help somebody else out. Let me get to that. HCR 4. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that version in?
Yes.
Okay, we'll bypass that. Chairman of the House Finance Committee's bill to this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS Frost Concurrent Resolution for State Affairs /N to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Any objection? Without objection, we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. We are back. Senate Finance. Gentlemen, if you can please bring out HB 77, Disability ID License and Training Requirements. We have Mr. Brody Anderson here to present the bill. Rep. Thompson's office. Mr. Anderson, if you can please identify yourself for the record. We've heard the bill. We had public testimony. We're just mainly looking for a brief statement and see if we have any questions from committee members.
Thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. He apologizes for not being able to be here due to prior conflicts with the scheduling. The goal of HB 77 is to improve communication between law enforcement professionals and other agencies that may interact with people who have non-apparent disabilities, whether these individuals encounter the system as victims, witnesses, or alleged perpetrators by having a discrete mark on the driver's license. Mr. Chairman, that summarizes the bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Anderson? Seeing none, Mr. Chairman, we are on HB 77, and we are ready to move the bill. Before we do that, let me just cover the fiscal note. I see fiscal note number 3, but I believe it's the only fiscal note in the packet. And that fiscal note demonstrates it is from the OMB component number is 2348, Department of Administration. The appropriation is motor vehicles, which is the same as the allocation. This is a zero fiscal note from FY17 through FY22 with no capital and no additional employees. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee substitute for House Bill 77 Finance, version 20.
Sorry, Martin. Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for House Bill number 77 Finance, excuse me, version 29-LS0072/P from committee with the attached fiscal notes and committee recommendations.
Any objections? Without objections from the committee, HB 77 moves from Senate Finance. We're going to take a brief at ease while we sign the transmittal document. We're back on as we're signing the transmittal document for HB 77. We are going to take two new testifiers for SB 130. Beginning with Mr. Curtis Thayer from the OFFNET. Mr. Thayer, you can identify yourself for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Okay, hello. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I represent the Alaska Chamber of Commerce, an organization with over 600 members, and we represent close to 100,000 working Alaskans. We are opposed to SB 130 in its current form. It is an improvement over the one that was originally introduced by the governor, but clearly it doesn't it still makes too many changes. Alaska oil tax system is balanced and is working as intended. We understand that we are in a deficit, but there are other areas to look first. One of the areas to look for is cutting state government. It is still too large. We can't afford the government we have. Before we look to the oil industry, one particular concern I have is the Cook Inlet. 10 years ago, I worked for a natural gas utility here in South Central. We had not had drilling in Cook Inlet for 8 years. We had threatened brownouts. And now, because of SB 21 and also the incentives into Cook Inlet, we have more production, more jobs, two new gas-fired power plants, and Homer now has natural gas. If we go back and take away those credits, and we take away and we renege on the promises that we made, we're going to go back to brownouts. And if you live in Anchorage, the Matsu, Kenai, Sedona, Homer, or even in Fairbanks, where they get their natural gas from Cook Inlet, it is just the wrong direction. I think we're looking at this, and there's unintended consequences that we're going to see for years to come. So I'd ask that you take a balanced approach, look at the voters' intent on SB 21, look at SB 130, and then look to find out if there's other areas that we can look towards. And again, we've got to look at the state budget. It is unsustainable, we can't afford it, and we need to reduce that. We have one member who had to lay off 100 employees, half his workforce. That's the same number of employees the state of Alaska has laid off in 2 years, and they have 16,000 employees. I thank you very much for your hard work down there, and good luck for Sunday night. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. Any questions for Mr. Thayer? Thanks for your testimony. The second person that was online has dropped off. So we're going to move to... Actually, we have 3 minutes for public testimony. We'll leave it open on SB 130. And we want to remind members of the public that they can certainly send us written testimony if we close public testimony prior to them having the opportunity to call in. So we are going to go to Senate Bill 206. That is the reinsurance program, health insurance waivers. We have Mr. Parody and staff here. If you want to please join us at the table. We're going to hear and hold this bill as well. But we covered it briefly the other day. We just thought we'd give you more of an opportunity to explain the bill. See if we have questions from committee members.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Parody. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. SB 206 addresses a vital issue for Alaska. The individual insurance market for health insurance in the state is in crisis. We've gone from 4 carriers to 2. One of those 2 carriers is in weakened financial condition. Both are losing tens of millions of dollars in our individual market. The basic problem is that our pool is too small and our costs are too high. So the essential framework of SB 206 is to use the existing statutory long-standing Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association vehicle to take a component of those high costs in the individual market and spread them over the individual and group market. In its essence, it takes the expiring federal fees and taxes, provides a mechanism for the division to set an assessment statewide over 236,000 covered lives, generating $55 million that would then reduce the increasing premium that's in the individual market. Mr. Chairman, there are Alaskans in the individual market whose health insurance premium is greater than their mortgage. Alaska is at risk for losing its remaining 2 carriers, and so it's a reasonable approach to make a positive improvement in the individual market by taking high-cost individuals and spreading those costs over a larger group. It's a difficult decision. There's nothing easy about it. What I would like to close on is 2 things. To reiterate that it's a wash with the expiring federal costs, and that it's necessary for Alaska to take action to preserve the companies that are operating in our individual market today.
Questions from committee members? Mr. Parity? Seeing none, Senator Dunleavy.
From the chair, what are some of the factors that the Division of Insurance will consider when deciding to ask for a waiver?
For the record, my name is Lori Winghire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska.
Thanks.
When we apply for a waiver, we would look at, first off, it's a very intense application process, and there will be public hearings where we will bring the stakeholders of not just legislature, the administration, public input, but from the providers and consumers to see what we would look for in the waiver. But things we would look for is the individual mandate as to what it should look like, as to when people should be allowed to participate, at what point they should be allowed not to participate when the cost becomes too high. Same for employers, eliminating the tax or the penalty for not participating in the employer or the individual mandate, because it does become a point in time for some where it becomes too restrictive or such a burden that they cannot participate in the individual plans. We should also look at the subsidies of perhaps smoothing the curve, because right now the curve for subsidies is very stark. I mean, it's just there's a line in the sand of when you qualify for a subsidy and when you don't. So we would look at smoothing that curve some. We would also look at things such as the out-of-pockets that are in the plans. There's quite a lot that we could do, but it would take working with the providers and the community to look at what we could do to bring the cost down for consumers. Some is the network adequacy that we struggle with in Alaska, because network adequacy was designed in D.C. as a one-size-fits-all, and because we are a very rural state, we struggle with that. So there's things like that that we would work on in our waiver process.
Through the chair, what type of opposition have you encountered along the way on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dunleavy, with regards, so the bill's got, as you've identified, really two key components. One is the ACHIA assessment process, and the other is the Section 1332 innovation waiver, the authorization to look more closely. And I don't believe we've received any opposition to the waiver process. As to the assessment process, Aetna has expressed opposition because of their interest in their group coverage, but the Premier and others have indicated support, so it's mixed.
Another question?
Senator Dunleavy.
Just a little detail on this, from your perspective, what are the pros and cons staying in a federal plan or leaving, if you can just state that for the public?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dunleavy, I believe that the pros are significant in the context that Alaska's individual insurance market, there are 22,000 insured lives there. They are generating tens of million dollars in losses due to the requirement to cover all individuals. You have a high cost number of individuals that come into that market and aren't spread across a large enough pool. So the pro is that you maintain coverage in the individual market, which is really for all Alaskans who aren't in a group plan or some other form of plan, and you ensure that you don't lose the carriers that you have in that individual market. The con is that you're spreading costs over a larger group, so there's a consequence to that.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Parrott, as you look at the program on this bill, how does it affect some of the beneficiaries that are under the IHS system, or does it help, hinder, or does it have no effect on those beneficiaries that are out there?
I believe it has no effect, but Mr. Chairman, Senator, but let me defer to Director Winghire.
Through the Chair, Senator Olson, it should not impact IHS beneficiaries one way or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question for you on page 2 of the sheet that the Director provided where it talks about the consumer impacts. Essentially what we're doing is spreading the cost to other covered industries. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
So when you talk about, for some reason, the 15% to 18% premium impact is highlighted on my sheet. Can you explain that, please?
Mr. Chairman, that is the impact. If you, so let me be clear that in the bill you're giving the division authority to set premiums and work through this process. If in fact the $19.30 projected estimate there was selected, you would generate $55 million and the estimated impact on individual insurance premiums would be 18% reduction. They've been experiencing 36% to 40% increases year on year for the last 2 years, and it's expected to have in the coming year a similar rate of increase. So it essentially cuts the rate of increase in half for the individual market. And those are, of course, estimates based on our actuarial studies.
So I have a follow-up for you, Mr. Parody. Doesn't this end up having a significant fiscal note on the state since the state covers the insurance costs for its own?
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that question is no, because the state does not carry stop-loss premium. It self-insures. So the affected groups are listed on page 1, the 236,000 insured lives, but that excludes state employees, so there is no state fiscal note.
Do you have a follow-up, Ms.? Can you say her last name again?
Mr. Chairman, it's Winghire. Mr. Chairman, the state is, they are self-insured. They have their own plan. They do not buy stop loss. So in those 236,779 lives, there are not any state employees. They were not in the original ACHEA plan, the high-risk pool. They never have been, and they would not be in this program either.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, we are going to hold this bill. If you have follow-up questions on HB 206, get them to the chair, or of course you can go directly through the deputy commissioner or the insurance director. Thanks to both of you for being here this morning. I have two last callers on. By the way, we're going to hold this bill if I didn't say that already. We have two last callers on SB 130, tax credits, interest, refunds, oil and gas. And then we are going to close public testimony on that bill. So the two last callers, we have Denise Calcope from Sutton. Denise, you have, or Delise, you have 2 minutes, please.
Okay, thank you. I'm in support of raising taxes on the fossil fuel industry in Alaska. Tax credits have been a huge investment in the fossil fuel industry for years. Other huge investments are noted in the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Investment Report dated December 31st, 2015. Are the Permanent Fund Board employees, investments in China, pages and pages of huge investments, include coal utility companies that are using coal from Alaska state lands, so we're actually paying for bad air to be produced from China, and affecting acidification of the waters, our children's future, our grandchildren's future, impacting the lifeways in the air, in the waters, and on the land. I'm really thankful that our children's trust case was just won. Thank you very much, and I sent you also the link to the court case win, as well as the Permanent Fund Investment Report dated December 31st, 2015. I'm not impressed. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you please identify yourself for the record, Ms. Calcope?
Yes. My name is Delise Calcote, D-E-L-I-C-E, Calcote, C-A-L-C-O-T-E. I'm speaking for myself, but as you know, I'm also the Executive Director of Alaska Intertribal Council. So I did send it out to the tribes, as well as you, as the committee, and you as individuals also.
Thank you, Ms. Calcote.
Get that in your email box.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none from committee members, we have our last person testifying this morning, Mr. Mike Coons, Mr. Coons, you have 2 minutes if you can identify yourself for the record.
Yes, this is Mike Coons, and I thank you for taking my testimony. I guess the opportune timing could be better because, unlike the previous person who is an environmentalist, I'm a conservationist. I believe in the proper use and the safe use of resources, which Alaska has epitomized over several decades. It is not us that have got the oil on the tundra. It's the federal government that is still doing those Liberty Wells. They haven't done what they're supposed to be doing. But that's not the reason I called. The reason I called is because the oil industry you all did the right thing with SB 21. That was well thought out. It was well heard. It was testimony, yada, 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 and forever. But you guys did the right job. And to turn around and change that and switch it back, the oil industry can only, do so much. It's a business. And they can't be in a position where Alaska does the right thing 1 year and then slips 10 steps backwards the next. So I oppose Senate Bill 130 on that standpoint. Let's keep SB 21 working. It has been working. It has developed more oil production and exploration. And we do not kowtow to the extreme left, especially the environmentalist factions who are there to lock up our lands, not open up and use our lands the way we should be. Thank you. Have yourself a great day.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. Questions for Mr. Coons? Seeing none, public testimony to Senate Bill 130 is now closed. We are still accepting written testimony on Senate Bill 130. Feel free to forward them to the committee chairs. With that, we're going to take a brief at ease. Brief at ease.
morning. We're back on the record. It's 9:15. The next bill before the committee is Senate Bill Number 55, Labor and Commerce, an act relating to practice of optometry. If I could invite Senator Giesel and her staff to the microphone to introduce the bill. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N, November. Madam Chair, this committee, first of all, thank you for hearing the bill, but this committee has worked hard on Medicaid reform this year and certainly focused on the cost of health care to Alaskans. You just heard a bill related to the cost of insurance. Madam Chair, this bill actually seeks to address the limited health care providers that we have in this state. Medicine, dentistry, and nursing are three professions that I think all of us are aware of, probably accessed at some point in your life, either that you or your family members. And each of these three health care professions regulate their own practice. The regulations are updated to comply with changes that occur in technology and education. Those regulations are updated by their boards. They don't have to come to the legislature to make statute changes each time. Senate Bill 55 is meant to modernize and update optometry statutes, aligning the practice of optometry with the modern-day scope of practice and allowing the Board of Optometry to regulate the profession just the way others do. The current Alaska statute defining the practice of optometry is 40 years old. For clarification for all of you, I suspect you know this, but in case the public doesn't, optometrists are eye care physicians. This bill moves things like continuing education requirements back into regulation that would be overseen by the Board of Optometry. This is pretty basic, Mr. Chairman. Regulations at this time already require 36 hours of continuing education every 2 years, which is vastly more than the 15 hours that we're removing from statute. The statutes are very outdated. Continuing education will still be required, but the hours and subjects will be determined by the Board of Optometry, just like is done with other professional boards. You've heard a lot this year about prescription drug schedules. Again, Medicaid reform. You know that scheduled drugs are controlled substances. This bill would allow the board, again, to determine which drugs could be prescribed by optometrists. You may recall a couple years ago that optometry had to come to the legislature to seek authorization in statute to continue to prescribe hydrocodone being previously scheduled a Schedule 3 drug, controlled substance. The federal government moved it up to Schedule 2. The board did not have the authority to make that change for optometrists, so they had to come to the legislature and run a bill in order to change that authorization. Optometrists have been prescribing hydrocodone for a number of years and are limited in the number of days they can prescribe that medication. So This bill would allow the Board of Optometry to define the scope of practice, what procedures they would be authorized to perform that would comply with their educational preparation, just like other boards. Now, Mr. Chairman, right now, optometrists are what we call primary care providers. So what is a primary care provider? A physician, family practice physician, a nurse practitioner, a dentist. Primary care, obviously the word means first, right, the entry-level health care provider. So optometrists number about 150 in our state. They're spread all over our state in small rural communities as well as our large cities. They are the first line eye care professionals that a vast majority of Alaskans see. In fact, nationally, about 85% of Americans see an optometrist for their eye care. It's likely even a higher percentage in Alaska. because these are folks that are readily accessible. In addition, optometrists travel to rural communities that are underserved to provide those services. So these folks are a lot like me, frankly. Mr. Chairman, nurse practitioners do the same thing. Many physicians, many family practice physicians also make a focused effort to make sure that they get out to rural communities to provide access to health care. By contrast, there is a medical specialty called ophthalmology. These are eye surgeons. There are approximately 25 of them in the state. And they provide specialized care, highly complex, specialized surgery. This has nothing to do with what optometrists do. Ophthalmologists are surgical specialists. Optometrists are primary care, eye care professionals. I bring this up, Mr. Chairman, because there's been significant drama about this bill. Maybe you've been to the movies lately, and during the pre-movie ads that you see, you will hear a dramatic reading of people dying and losing their eyesight if Senate Bill 55 passes. Maybe you listen to the radio. There are ads running all over the state saying that if Senate Bill 55 passes, people will die and their eyes will be permanently damaged. It goes on and on. There are mailings. There are direct phone calls being made to citizens. All of this is dramatization in an attempt to continue to constrain the Board of Optometry's ability to simply oversee their healthcare professionals. I will remind you, and probably most of you know, that when a professional board is overseeing their profession, they write regulations. Those regulations are reviewed by the Department of Law, Mr. Chairman. The Department of Law determines whether the board and that profession has the ability to do whatever the regulation they're writing says. In other words, there's oversight. And having served on the Board of Nursing, I can tell you that there was certainly a regulation project that the Board of Nursing put out 1 year that the Board of Law came back, or the Department of Law came back and said, sorry, you don't have the authority to do this. And so those regulations had to go away. There is oversight, Mr. Chairman. I would also point out that the Federal Trade Commission, of course, has national oversight, and in 2015, actually about 2010, they've brought a suit against the North Carolina State Board of Dental Examiners. This board was attempting to prohibit the practice of tooth whitening. And it's noted in an article that the FTC noted that the abuse of power frequently occurs when governments empower private parties to exploit licensing laws to, quote, advance their own interests in restricting competition at the expense of public interest, end quote. In the end of at the end of the day, this was last year, the FTC did find that the Board of Dental Examiners in that state was excessively restraining trade for other professionals in the dental profession. Mr. Chairman, this bill simply authorizes the Board of Optometry to conduct itself like other healthcare professionals do. We trust other boards to do the right thing. The Board of Medicine, the Board of Nursing, the Board of Dentistry, chiropractic examiners, physical therapists and occupational therapists, pharmacists. We trust these boards. I suggest that the Board of Optometry should equally be trusted, Mr. Chairman. That is the purpose of Senate Bill 55. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Questions for Senator Giesel before we go to a sectional? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Giesel, it's pretty clear on what you on what the bill does. I don't know if you're the correct one to ask this question, but this bill allows for future new and improved diagnostic and therapeutic procedures. And is that just a catch-all, or is there some new stuff coming down the line that would help the optometrist prefer to do a better job?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, there are some optometrists, both online and one present in the room, that would best be able to answer that. So I would prefer to defer that question to them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop, after they're through with the sectional, we have Dr. Michael Brennan online from the American Academy of Ophthalmology, several others to testify, and then if we have Division of Professional Licensing questions, of course, Sarah Chambers is in the room as well. If there are no other questions for the Senator, Ms. Conway, could you provide a sectional analysis, please?
Good morning. My name is Jane Conway, staff to Senator Kathy Giesel. I will go through the sectional for Senate Bill 55. In Section 1, it amends 0872050 regulations. And this adds to this section the power for the board to adopt regulations allowing the prescription and pharmaceutical agents for the treatment of eye disease, and also under agreement with the State Medical Board, it will prescribe the scope of practice for a licensee to perform ophthalmic surgery and non-invasive procedures. Section 2 amends 0872181D by requiring specific hours and period of continuing education requirements for the renewal of an optometrist license, but it retains delegation of those requirements to the board and into regulation, and we spoke about that earlier, that we're taking those things out of statute and putting back into continuing education back into regulations. Section 3 repeals and reenacts 0872272A to provide that pharmaceutical agents, including controlled substances, may be used by a licensed optometrist if consistent with the standards adopted by the board and any limitations on practice that you find in Section 5. Section 4, 0872272, amends and adds new subsections prohibiting an optometrist to make injections into the ocular globe of the eye, limits the prescribing of controlled substance in quantities exceeding 7 days, and requires that a referral to a physician or ophthalmologist would be required if a longer prescription is needed. In Section 5, 0872 was amended, and a new section is added, limitation on practice, provides that a licensee may perform only services within the licensee's training, education, and experience as provided by board regulation. And Section 6 revises the definition of optometry. With that, Mr. Chair, that concludes the sectional analysis.
Thank you, Ms. Conway. Questions for Ms. Conway? Okay, we are going to open public testimony, and then we'll come back to questions from some of the experts online. Thank you for presenting your bill. In the room, we have Jill Matheson from the Alaska Optometric Association. Jill?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Dr. Jill Matheson. I'm an optometrist here in Juneau, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 55. I've been in practice for 24 years here, and during that time, I've served on two terms on the Alaska Board of Optometry, one term as chair. Through the years, there have been many optometry bills that have expanded our scope of practice to what they are today, to what we can do today. And again, just to reiterate, every time one of those new procedures or treatments came up, we had to go through the legislature to get approval for that. And the legislature has been very attentive to our needs, and we've always come out really well as far as being able to supply our patients with what they need. You know, over the years, through all of that testimony, we've had a lot of scare tactics that we're going to harm people or blind people. Now we have very negative public campaigns that are offensive to us. but we're going to continue moving forward. The point of Senate Bill 55 is to give the optometry board, again, the optometry board are people that are appointed by the legislators and approved by the governor, to give that board the sole oversight over the practice of optometry. So this bill does not expand their privileges. We are not asking to do surgery, and it allows the board to react quicker through that quicker regulatory process and less costly regulatory process when changes need to be made. The problem with the current language of the bill is Section 1, Number 6, on line 12 of page 1, the words, by agreement with the state medical board, unfortunately take us far away from the intended goal of the bill, and would increase costs exponentially by not only having one board figuring all this out, but having two boards having to regulate our profession. So I would formally request that, those seven words, by agreement with the state medical board, be removed. Again, this bill is to have the optometry board be self-regulated, just like the nurse practitioner and dentist. The optometry board has never been under the medical board, and there's no need for that language in there at this point. With the financial, you know, crisis that we're dealing with, the cost of having two boards trying to agree on regulations for optometrists really wouldn't be fiscally responsible in my mind. So by removing that language, the optometry board would have a very manageable, cost-effective regulation project to meet the statute, and that would be it. So having been on the board for two terms, I know that the board understands the gravity of the decisions that they make, and I also know that they understand that optometrists are, and we always will be, held to the same level of care as any health profession for any given procedure. So I trust that they would not allow optometrists to do anything without proper training, just as their prior track record has shown. I'd like to just close. There was a question regarding if there are new things that are coming down the pipeline. I guess my answer to that is I can't really think of anything specific at this point. The point is that language is broad, so because there is always new things coming up. And so the language is broad so that, and by design, encompasses any of the unknown things that may be developed down the road. So thank you for your time. Would like to encourage you to support Senate Bill 55 with that minor change. And again, thank you for your time, and appreciate all of your efforts this session. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Matheson. Questions for Ms. Matheson?
Yes, ma'am. Could you repeat the section in line? Because I had a bill
yes.
here that might be different now.
Through the chair, I would be happy to. It's Section 1, line number 6. It's on line 12 of page 1.
Got it.
So it would be those first, I believe it's the first seven words, by agreement with the state medical board. Just removing that would be helpful.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Matheson, thank you very much for coming out this morning. I'm sure you have a busy practice that people are waiting for. I guess one of the questions I have you ever been on the optometry board?
I have been on the optometry board.
Been on the optometry.
Yes.
So you're familiar with some of the complaints and some of the malpractices, if there are any, and have there been any?
Through the chair, thank you. I missed that sentence in my testimony here. During my time on the board, and I was on the board for 8 years, so two terms, we did not have any complaints of optometrists. My understanding is that since then, there still have not been any open cases of optometrists being investigated for harming a patient. So our track record is good.
One last question, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
As you look at this bill, how does it change your scope of practice in optometry?
Through the chair, thinking about the answer to that, I think what it does is it just allows us to be able to provide for our patients at the highest level that we can. So when those new procedures, sometimes things come up really quickly, and we need to be able to adapt. You know, there's all sorts of potential things out there that optometrists, if that got approved, would need to be able to do on a daily basis. So without going into too many specific things about what may or may not ever be approved, it's hard to predict.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
And Well, have you ever practiced in rural Alaska?
Through the chair, I have not practiced in rural Alaska.
No further questions, Madam, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions from committee members? Thank you, Ms. Dr. Matheson. In Anchorage, we have Jeff Gonison, Legislative Chair of the Alaska Optometry Association. Mr. Gonison, 2 minutes, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Jeff Gonison, OD. I represent the Alaska Optometry Association. I was the first Alaska Native optometrist licensed in Alaska for 39 years. I have twice served as a member and as chair of the State Optometry Board under two different governors. And at that time, we never had any complaints of harm to any patients. Briefly, the four learned professions of medicine, dentistry, optometry, and advanced practice nurses are all independent, all have their own state regulatory boards, and are all currently authorized by Alaska state law to treat diseases and prescribe drugs, including controlled substances, with DEA numbers. Optometrists have been defined as physicians under federal Medicare for many years and are held to the same standard of care. Optometry's professional doctor's degree was brought up to the same level of training as medicine and dentistry over 45 years ago. A bachelor's degree followed by a 4-year graduate school program with available residencies for advanced training. Now, optometrists practice all over the state, provide the vast majority of eye care in Alaska. As you heard, local optometrists are called upon very often at rural hospitals for their expertise. Treatment and travel costs greatly increase when routine care is provided by urban specialists. And to answer Dr. Olson's question, I've seen patients in Tetitlik, Kotzebue, Bethel, Cordova, and Yakutat in my earlier days all over the state. Now, every time optometry has come to any state legislature in the country over the past 40 years, the Ophthalmologist National Academy and the politically organized MDs have testified and advertised that optometrists are untrained, will be killing or blinding people, that we didn't go to medical school, well, dentists don't go to medical school, they have their own board, and that these bills are a medical emergency, and none of these claims are true, and or have ever come true. So please review the historical record if you wish. There's never been any issue of harm in Alaska. Now, we have no feud with the ophthalmologists in Alaska. We work with them every day, just as family doctors work with cardiologists, for example. So to sum up, SB 55 does not authorize optometrists to do anything. It's no blank check. It only updates the old statutes and gives the State Optometry Board better autonomy to regulate, the same as dentists and advanced practice nurses. So optometry does not have to continue return for legislation for every new advance in technology. The board would never authorize optometrists to perform anything they are not trained and qualified to do, and this is clearly spelled out in Section 5 of the bill. But to go forward, we respectfully request that this current version, those first 7 words be deleted, and those words are by agreement with the state medical board. This was inserted at the CS at the last moment, which poisons the bill. Optometry has its own state board to protect the public, as do dentists and advanced nurses. The medical board never agrees to anything optometry proposes, being in competition, and only serves to let them try to exert control over another independent state board. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Gonison. Questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Gonison, thank you very much for coming out this morning. I guess one of the questions that I have, what you just talked about, related to the CS that was added, where it was added, are there any other professionals that are out there that are under two boards, as is proposed in this CS, where you've got both the optometry board as well as the state medical board having control over your license with the I'm assuming that the medical board has the power to go in and suspend and revoke your license as well. Is there any other trained professionals, whether inside the medical field or outside the medical field, that are under two boards like this?
No, there are none. The podiatrists, for example, are under the medical board by agreement years ago because they do foot surgery and they're under that. They don't have their own board because there's so few of them. But there are no other professions that are under two boards. And this language in the bill essentially defeats the bill.
It certainly appears to put double jeopardy on you. Mr. Chairman, I do have another question, if I could.
Continue, sure.
It has to do with training, Dr. Gonison. As you looked at the training that you had when you went to optometry school versus the training that's out there now, has there been any significant changes within the recent past as to how the training has been going on in some of the optometry schools?
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Olson, yes, the medicine, dentistry, optometry, all areas of healthcare have expanded greatly in the last 10 to 20 years. There's new drugs, new procedures. It's crazy how fast so many of the studies from the National Institute of Health and the National Eye Institute bring out new treatments and so forth. For example, we had very little treatments for eye allergy and itching, and now we have five or six new drugs that we've been using the last few years. That's one example. The training is, since I went to school, is greatly increased. That's why I attend so much continuing education and continuing medical education, as all doctors do.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. No additional questions? Okay, thank you, Dr. Gonison. Next, we have Dr. Paul Barney in Anchorage, Chairman, Board of Optometry.
Hi, thank you, committee members, for allowing me to speak today. My name is Dr. Paul Barney. I'm the current chair of the Alaska Board of Examiners in Optometry. I'm also a past president of the Alaska Optometric Association. As you know, SB 55 in its original form was a bill written to put the regulatory details regarding the practice of optometry in the authority of the Board of Optometry, similar to how dentistry, nurse practitioners, and medicine are regulated. The current committee substitute for SB 55 is excellently written, with the exception of one clause. That one clause, or without that clause, we would achieve what the original bill was set out to do. But because of this unfavorable wording, the committee substitute would actually decrease the current scope of practice and make it unlikely the profession could advance with advancing training and technology. You're already aware of the words of concern, and they're found in Section 1, Section 08.72.050, Paragraph 6, by agreement with the State Medical Board. Those words would effectively make it impossible for the practice of optometry to advance with advancing training and technology, since it's almost certain that the medical board would never agree to allow optometry to have expanded privileges. Proof of that can be seen in recent radio ads and theater ads that medicine has sponsored smearing the profession of optometry, as well as previous testimony that medicine has provided opposing SB 55. Their testimony and radio ads have clearly stated that they feel that medical procedures can only be taught and learned in medical schools, but yet we all know that dentists, podiatrists, and advanced practice nurses perform medical procedures safely every day. I'm confident that that medicine will argue that the words by agreement with the State Medical Board are necessary to protect the public, but the bill already has adequate provisions in it to protect the public. Section 5 clearly states that the scope of practice must be within the licensee's education, training, and experience as determined by the board. The Board of Optometry has the same oversight from the Alaska Attorney General's office as all other healthcare providers. If the Board of Optometry did try to write regulations allowing optometrists to do procedures that were outside of their training, the Alaska Attorney General's office would know about it and the regulations would never come to fruition. This oversight by the Attorney General's office has been proven to work very well with other healthcare professions, and there's no reason to assume that it would fail with optometry. As chair of the Alaska Board of Examiners in Optometry, I can assure you that the primary concern of the Board of Optometry is the safety of the public. In the 4 years that I've served on the board, We've had no complaints from the public that were serious enough to even consider disciplinary action. In general, optometrists are conservative and cautious providers, and the passage of SB 55 would not change their conservative nature. I should also note that optometrists and ophthalmologists work well with one another locally, and that opposition from SB 55 comes largely from national medical associations outside of Alaska. Requiring agreement with the medical board is an unnecessary requirement and will effectively ensure that optometry does not advance. And although medicine might like to see optometry stagnate, if that happens, Alaskans will lose. Such a scenario would certainly not entice new practitioners to come to Alaska, nor would it allow current practitioners to provide state-of-the-art care. Optometry provides approximately 70% of the eye care in the U.S. and Alaska, and in most rural areas of Alaska, optometrists are the only eye care provider in the community. Ultimately, if optometry suffers from unnecessary regulation, Alaskans will lose by having less access to care. If the words "by agreement with the state medical board" were stricken from the aforementioned paragraph, this would be a good bill for optometry and for Alaskans. And I urge you to strike those words and pass an amended version of SB 55. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Barney. Questions for Dr. Barney? Seeing none, thank you. Next, we have Carl Rosen, ophthalmologist at the Anchorage, OffNet, actually. Mr. Rosen.
Yes. Yes, hi. Carl Rosen here. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm an ophthalmologist with a subspecialty in neuro-ophthalmology and oculoplastics. I'm the only neuro-ophthalmologist and oculoplastic ophthalmology specialist in Alaska. I've been here at Dominic Associates in Anchorage for 22 years. I had degrees from Boston University School of Medicine and Harvard Medical School. I've taken emergency call for Alaska for 22 years as well. And I just wanted to touch on a few simple topics. I only have a few minutes. One is primary eye care is also part of my purview and my partner's purviews. Not only do I take care of facial fractures, cancers, work with neurosurgery, plastic, ENT, oral surgery, on a weekly basis, but we also take care of many just fundamental issues with the eye and the orbit and the periorbital area. Additionally, I've also been a past president of the Alaska State Medical Association, so I'm in touch with the medical community, as well as the nursing community, the podiatric community, and the optometry community. I do have an optometrist in my practice. We work well together. Chairman Costello did a very thoughtful analysis, and the addition of the medical board is an essential oversight and what I believe to be a good sounding board for all parties, just to keep everyone at the same level, working together in an appropriate manner. This is a really big pivot point here for optometry. This is a gargantuan move, and I think we have to be careful and thoughtful as to how we move forward. My partners and myself have provided outstanding care, again, in conjunction with the medical community and the various other specialists in the community. However, the medical board does need to be part of this bill and this measure. I think stripping out those seven words would be a very bad idea. So I also wanted to mention one other thing. There was a malpractice case that came up about 4 years ago involving an optometrist. So just wanted to correct that and highlight that. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to take those.
No, thank you, Dr. Rosen. Any questions for Dr. Rosen? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Rosen, this is Senator Olson here. I was wondering, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on up here and practicing your neuro-ophthalmology as well as taking care of some of the very complex issues that come up with with head and facial injuries related to the eye. One of the questions you have been, it looks like you're, one of the issues that you have come up with has to do with the medical board. Since I've been on the medical board in the past, prior to becoming an elected official, I was wondering, have you ever been on the medical board?
I have not been on the medical board, but I've dealt with the medical board very closely. John Troxell and I, John was on the medical board years ago, where we worked, we were almost business partners, essentially, in the operating room. We worked very closely together, so I had an intimate relationship with the medical board, but to answer your question, I was not an elected member there.
And the other question I have, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue?
Please.
Has to do with the training that optometrists go through. You're obviously very familiar with the training, but not only the medical school that you've gone to, as well as the residency training and then the subspecialty training that you've gone through. Are you familiar with the training that the optometrists currently go through?
So, you know, that's an interesting question. I actually made an attempt to visit an optometry school down in Washington State, and I was boycotted. This was probably about 8 years ago, but I did make an attempt to actually investigate and see what I could to, you know, to answer these fundamental questions. And what you have to understand is that you know, ophthalmology is a very select subspecialty within medicine. I mean, you have to be top of your medical school class to get selected, and then you have to be able to maintain the residency and the physical and mental challenges that come with that. You are constantly tested, constantly scrutinized. You are evaluated. You know, you have to keep a manual of procedures. You have to walk out with 120 cataract surgeries. You have to come out with various, you know, glaucoma surgeries, strabismus surgeries, orbital surgeries to move on. So, you know, this is not a weekend 32-hour course. This is, in my case, internship, residency, fellowship. This was 5 years of intensive training, 110-hour weeks, requiring, you know, sleeping in the hospital to not only do my specialty work, but to do regular primary eye care as well. You cannot gather this by an online course. You need to be evaluated, and you need to be trained by attendings and professionals who actually care about the training, care about your progress, and ensure that you have the capability. Not everyone is actually capable to do many of these things that are in this bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue.
Senator Olson.
Have you ever practiced out in rural Alaska, Dr. Rosen?
No, I mean, I did. You know, I mean, I see patients from all over the state, but there's just too much going on. In fact, I have quite a few things that are already happening since about 5:30 this morning.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
And I hesitate to go ahead and bring this up, Dr. Rosen, from such a hardworking and respectable group as the ophthalmologists, but it's very disturbing when I, as a healthcare professional, see ads put on the in the public media to go ahead and to try and achieve an end, as we've seen and have been talked about by a number of people that have testified prior to you. My question to you is you or your organization behind it, and you have the option of not answering the question.
So, I mean, I think it's a fair question, it's a delicate question. You know, you have to understand that we are here every few years. This is a very onerous task to, you know, gather ourselves together and marshal the troops, so to speak, to take time and to do these testimonies, to talk to folks, to come down to Juneau. And at some point, enough is enough. You know, practice your specialty. If you really do want to do the things that are in this bill, you know, please, we encourage it, but take the MCAT, go to medical school, do an ophthalmology residency, and then, you know, we'd be happy to have you join us. But to constantly legislate and, you know, to ask a group of folks that are not experts in many of these procedures, it's disingenuous, and we've, you know, we have to draw the line at some point.
So the answer to the question is?
It wasn't us locally. It was from a national level.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment.
Certainly, Doug.
Having practiced medicine out in rural Alaska since 1984 and having dealt with optometrists in the past, I was somewhat offended at those advertisements that were out there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. and Senator Olson. Any other questions for Dr. Rosen? Seeing none, thank you, Dr. Rosen. I see no one else online for testifying. We have Ms. Chambers here, if anyone has any questions of the Division of Professional Licensing. Would you like me to bring Ms. Chambers up?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay before we end this part of the meeting, if Senator Giesel could come back up, just add a quick question for her.
Certainly. Senator Giesel.
Senator, through the chair. Absolutely. Senator Giesel, just a quick question for the average person listening online. Can you just tell us what this bill would allow or not allow optometrists to do in terms of surgery? And I may have a follow-up after that, but just from your perspective in this bill, if this bill is passed as it is, what can optometrists do once this bill is passed that they can't do now? And what type of, quote, surgery, or however you want to word it, can or can they not do?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Senator Kathy Giesel, District N. Senator Dunleavy, through the chair. Senator Dunleavy, there are invasive surgeries that ophthalmologists, surgical specialists, do on the eye. These are prohibited in the bill. If you go to page 2 of the bill, line 18 is where the section begins, I believe. The licensee may not perform an injection into the ocular globe of the eye. So, believe me, my specialty is not the eyes. I'm a family practice nurse practitioner, but that means the actual globe itself, you know, like if you kill a moose, you know, you pop the eyeball out, an optometrist would not be able to invade that space or inject it. A retinal detachment would certainly be referred to an ophthalmologist were that professional available. But let's say you're out fishing on the Kenai and you get a fish hook in your eye or in your eyelid. An optometrist could perform that emergency procedure of removing that fish hook. A piece of metal, perhaps you're working in your shop on your truck, and a fragment of metal gets into your cornea, and you're out in Kaktovik, let's say. You need to have that removed. Your closest healthcare professional who specializes in eye care as an optometrist, that optometrist can remove that piece of metal before it stains your cornea permanently. But invading the eyeball itself is a specialty with a surgical requirement, and my hat off to those folks. We need those specialties, and I appreciate them. But it's the same as my own regulatory statutes. I'm a family practice nurse practitioner. I can repair a simple laceration, but I don't have the education to remove what might be a carcinogenic lesion on the skin. I would never attempt that because I haven't had that specialized education. So there is a lot of professional judgment that happens at my level as well, at all professionals. Dr. Olson, you'll probably notice, doesn't do heart surgery or brain surgery, and yet his statutes are wide open concerning that. They don't prohibit it. He could, but he knows that he's not qualified to do that.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. And to the best of your knowledge, the surface of the eye, whether it's, and this gets a little dicey because, for example, LASIK surgery or some type of, you have a cataract or something. who performs that surgery now, and would that, or that operation or procedure, however you want to word it, now, and who could, or if anything changes on that with this bill, if you could let us know.
Cataract surgery is exactly that, surgery. It is not done by optometry. LASIK surgery is not, the LASIK procedure, to my understanding, in the state of Alaska, is not authorized by the Board of Optometry. I don't know that they would authorize it. It is a specialized specialized education. You've asked more than I know regarding LASIK surgery, but I certainly know that a cataract removal and surgery is not done by optometrists.
And if I may, Senator Giesel, when you answered the question, you talked about Section 4. Section 5 also clarifies a limitation on practice as optometry is defined. Section 5 in B says a licensee may not perform ophthalmic surgery as described by the board regulation if the surgery is beyond the scope of the licensee's education training.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is true.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Did you say ophthalmologist surgery?
Ophthalmic.
And that's on Section 5?
In Section 5,
page 200.
Under B.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
It's more of a comment to Senator Giesel on responding to Senator Dunleavy's question about what they can and can't do. And you listed two examples in rural Alaska or somewhere where a fish hook could be taken out or a piece of metal, a foreign object. But I would just say that if that optometrist in that situation looked at it, and the severity could be that, do you know what? I'm going to refer you to my local ophthalmologist. Is that to do that, or a surgeon or something, right? I mean, it's just, I would think common sense would prevail. You know, they have the ability to do that emergency repair, but also it could be beyond their scope, and they'd make a recommendation to go somewhere else.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, certainly a fish hook penetrating the globe of the eye into the vitreous body would be a very complex removal of a fish hook. I would believe that the average optometrist would probably, if an ophthalmologist were available, refer that. I will also bring to your attention the fact that we are expanding healthcare through the use of telemedicine, telehealth in our state through the Medicaid reform bill. And I will tell you that the Alaska Native Medical System has taken care of complex patients through that venue, where a family practice physician has actually done abdominal surgery using a teleconferencing connection to a surgeon in Anchorage. Alaska is a very unique place in so many ways, but healthcare delivery is another one of them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there questions for Senator Giesel? Seeing no other questions, do we have any questions for Ms. Chambers from the Division of Professional Licensing?
Actually, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ms. Chambers, can you join us, please? Put yourself on the record. I'm also closing public testimony. Public testimony on Senate Bill 55 is closed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Division Operations Manager for the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Chambers, thanks for coming out this morning. It has to do with the idea that all of a sudden you have trained professionals that are now under two boards. Since you're the director of the operations section of it, has this ever happened before where a licensee is under two boards and has essentially the double jeopardy of having his license either suspended or any kind of license action taken against the licensee?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, no, this the model that's proposed hasn't taken place, so is not currently taking place. There are collaborative practice agreements between different license types, but those are under one board. There isn't a crossover between two boards.
Having been on the medical board, I'm familiar with some of the collaborative agreements between the PAs and the licensed physician that has the DEA number. But you are in agreement that the medical board could indeed take license action against the licensee. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the bill as it stands with the line that has been brought up, line 12 on page 1, poses a few logistical concerns. One is that because 080864, the medical board statutes, are not amended, there's nothing to require the medical board to do this, to enter into an agreement or even entertain a conversation with the Board of Examiners in Optometry. I think there's some logistical concerns that would probably stymie what this bill is attempting to accomplish.
Last question, Mr. Chairman, and that has to do with the liberty of asking if the department is in favor of this amendment or of this portion of the bill that was just put into the bill from the last committee of referral.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we haven't taken a formal position on the bill itself. Our concern is with, again, the logistics and operations. We have been in consultation with our Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, who has raised their own concern about this type of language on line 12 on page 1, that it would be, as I've said, it would not require the medical board to take any action and would cause some logistical problems between the two boards.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. Having been to law school, I find this troublesome as well.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chambers.
Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, why wouldn't your outfit take a position on a bill such as this? If we're talking about surgery, we're talking about boards, et cetera, et cetera.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that's a good question. We, where there is a clear desire from one board to accomplish a particular goal, we sometimes will take a position to support that board. Because we have two entities, the Board of Examiners and Optometry, who have requested this change in legislation, and then members, a contingent of licensees of the medical board, who have clearly oppose this. The medical board itself has not taken a position on the bill, but we have decided, since there is such a conflict between those two licensing groups, and also since we are not board members, we are not the ones with the governance responsibility over things such as surgery, we've decided to remain neutral.
The chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
But if you're dealing with an issue that some would consider to be life safety, surgery, non-surgery, that sort of thing, it would make sense that in something like this, you would your outfit would have some position or some statement. So, do you see anything in this bill that is not? Is there anything in this bill that's dangerous in terms of? I don't know how to word this. I have to assume that by not taking a position, the your entity sees no issue with the bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I could. Just comment on that.
Yes, Senator Olson.
The people that are in the department looking over licenses are not trained medical professionals, and so have a very difficult time to go ahead and try and, especially if it's in conflict with somebody's opinion, that would be just one professional person's opinion. They're not in, at least when I was on the medical board, it was clear that, you know, some people came from, and not to demean them, just they came from a different background that didn't have any medical training, and they were doing a job there and doing it very well. And so the ability to come up with something that's as important, like you say, would be unfair for somebody that's not trained in the medical field.
I appreciate that, and I'll close by saying oftentimes my bills seem to garner a lot of opinions from folks that may not necessarily be experts in certain fields. I was just wondering if that transferred to other fields as well, but thank you.
I think it's specifically a Dunleavy problem, but aside from I think Ms. Chambers' role, typically she comments on mechanical issues versus policy issues, and that's probably an appropriate response. Mr. Chairman, did you have a comment, question? Okay, with that, thank you, Ms. Chambers. We are moving here to toward an amendment that I believe Senator Olson would like to offer on this bill. Has the amendment been distributed? Yes. Senator Olson, do you have an amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number one.
I'll object for purposes of an explanation.
Amendment number one has to do with deleting on page 1, line 12, the portion that says by agreement with the state medical board. Essentially, it goes back to the original bill as was written. And the reason that I go ahead and oppose that is that, one, as a MD myself, and having worked with optometrists very closely out in rural Alaska, essentially all my time has been spent out in rural Alaska practicing medicine, and having been on the medical board from the early 90s until I was elected in 2000, seeing what goes on and the complexity, as was talked about by Ms. Chambers, related to the legality of being overseen by two boards, I find this cumbersome and unneeded at this point. And so with that, I ask for support for amendment number one.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, can we have the sponsor comment on the amendment, please?
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Senator Kathy Giesel, District N, I support the amendment.
Senator Kelly?
Thank you.
I remove my objection. Any additional objection to the amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment one is adopted. Any additional committee discussion on Senate Bill 55? Seeing none, we are going to hold this bill for now. And this is the last item on our agenda today. At 1 p.m., we have HB 188, Person with Disability Savings Accounts, HB 222, Increase of Appropriation Item, SB 130, Tax Credits, Interest, and Refunds, and HB 247 with the same title. We'll have invited testimony from Analytica and the Department of Revenue, and we may hear bills previously heard or scheduled. With that, if there's nothing else to come before us from committee members, we are adjourned at 10:13 a.m.